As I intend to do whenever there is a special Haftorah like this Shabbos, I'm going to spend half the time on the what would normally be the Haftorah of Mishpatim, and half the time on the Haftorah we will actually say this Shabbat. Okay, so let's start with Yirmiyahu. Okay. Yirmiyahu ties into the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. Of all the laws that Mishpatim concentrates on to begin the Parsha, it's the law of Eved Ivri. Remember, we were just slaves in Egypt. Okay? So the Torah does not out and out prohibit and forbid and outlaw slavery. Rather, what it does is it constricts it. It defines it. I probably shouldn't call it slavery. We should probably call it some kind of indentured servitude or something like that. And it's meant to be rehabilitative. You cannot learn Parshas Mishpatim without oral tradition. Without oral tradition, we wouldn't know that ayin tachas ayin means that if someone takes out another person's eye or tooth, that he has to pay. He doesn't get his own eye or tooth removed. Right? I just saw a YouTube clip of Rav Soloveitchik speaking in Yiddish in 1954 about a UN proclamation that was critical of Israel for engaging in eye for eye and tooth for tooth, like tit for tat kind of response to an Egyptian terrorism. So they used to say that if you wanted to get off doing jury duty, all you had to do was tell the lawyers that you believe in Old Testament punishment, right? Like an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and they'll let you off. So it's other nonsense. Judaism does not profess eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth punishment. That is known in Greek as lex talionis, and we don't have such a rule. Well, if you didn't have oral tradition, you might not know that. Okay? If you wanted to ask, so why didn't the Torah just write mamon tachas ayin, mamon tachas regel, mamon tachas kfiya, mamon tachas, right? Money instead of a tooth, money instead of an eye, etc., 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 etc. So the answer is, if the Torah had written that, then it might draw someone to the erroneous conclusion that a human being can be reduced and limited to monetary parts of the body. A rich person can maim with impunity, right? I have the money. I can take out eyes. I can rip out teeth, right? So, okay, I just want to point out that you can't understand the parasha of Eved Ivri without an acceptance of the Torah Shebaal Peh, without the acceptance of the oral tradition. The oral tradition maintains that the Eved Ivri in Parshas Mishpatim is someone who was sold into slavery because he stole something and couldn't pay it back. Okay? That person is sold as a slave for 6 years. Okay? Yirmiyahu chapter 34 is about the rebukements to Bnei Yisrael for not letting slaves go free after the 6 years of servitude were finished. Right? It stands on, if you know your Yirmiyahu, it stands on the heels of chapter 32, which is the Haftorah of Parshas Bahar, which is really the essential socioeconomic welfare parasha of the Torah, all right? It also deals with slaves, freeing slaves, right? So in chapter 32, Yirmiyahu talks about the imperative of returning land to its original owners in Israel in the Yovel year. Mm-hmm. Hence the connection to Parshas Bahar. You get it? Okay. So now the Yirmiyahu continues with the socioeconomic welfare exhortations by complaining about Bnei Yisrael not letting the slaves go free in time, in good time. Okay. I would like to direct you to an incredible chiddush of the Bechor Shor, which one can say based on Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu explicitly lists in our who needs to mute out there?
What are you Lipson?
Okay. Here's the incredible Chiddush. Yirmiyahu in chapter 34 tells the Jews that they need to set their slaves free at the end of 7 years. Mm-hmm. He says, Miketz Sheva Shonim. At the end of 7 years, you need to obey the Torah law and set your slaves free. Now, that is decidedly not the Torah law, because the Torah law is at the end of 6 years, not seven. Yeah. Okay. If you have Yirmiyahu chapter 34 open in front of you, you will find this in the text in Pasuk Tes. Mm-hmm. Right? And he says you should crow drawer to set them free. Right? And then a few psukim later, he says, Miketz Sheva Shanim, Pasuk Yudalid, at the end of 7 years, to Shalchu Isha Sochiv HaIvri. What's with that? I mean, this is the flagrant difference in Torah law. The Torah says after 6 years he goes free. And here it says after 7 years you go free. So Rashi's approach to this is to say something that is really not pshat. Can someone just translate the words for me, Miketz Sheva Shanim?
The end of 7 years.
At the end of 7 years. Rashi translates that at the beginning of 7 years.
There's no way to look at that.
Miketz does not mean at the end, says Rashi. Miketz means, sometimes it does, in Parshas Miketz it does, but Miketz in some instances can mean like the word kotze. Kotze can mean beginning or the end. Kotze means the border. So Miketz Sheva Shanim, according to Rashi, means in the beginning of the seventh year. Rashi is sort of pushed into that position not only so that Yirmiyahu can be consistent with the Torah, but that Yirmiyahu can be consistent with himself. He says later in the same Haftorah that the amount of time for slaves, for slavery is 6 years, not seven. Okay? You see it? You want to read it? Right? You see? Right, it says, V'avodcha sheish shanim. I mean, the Pasuk itself, Pasuk Yudalid, is profoundly internally contradictory if you say Miketz means at the end of. So Rashi is sort of forced into the position that Miketz means at the beginning of here. Okay, but why does Yirmiyahu use such an unusual term? Let me tell you now, if you've never heard this chiddush of Bechor Shor, sit down. It's an amazing chiddush. And whenever you see a chiddush like this, but you don't find it anywhere in the Talmud, anywhere in like rabbinic literature, anywhere in the Rambam, the place to look at when this happens is Menachem Kasher's Torah Shlema. You've heard of it? It's now these 10 big volumes. All the libraries have them now. It used to be in every parsha was like one or two volumes. The whole thing was like 60, 70 volumes. He never finished the work. He went until Matos Masei, and he died over the age of 100. And then he had a son who was trying to complete the project, but then the son died young. Anyway, Menachem Kasher's work is called Torah Shlema. And I found this in Torah Shlema also. He claims it's a Zohar, and here is what it is. Ready? It says in the Torah, Ki tikne eved ivri, sheish shonim ya'avod. Uvashviis yetze chofshi chinam. Can someone translate those last four Hebrew words? Uvashviis.
And in the seventh year, he shall go free.
What else can uvashviis mean?
In the seventh.
What else is known as Shviis in the Torah?
When the crops, you can't
plant. Shmita year, yes. There's Maseches Shviis in the Talmud.
The Shmita year.
Right? The Shmita year. Okay. So B'chor Shor, without any Gemara to point to, B'chor Shor, of Yosef B'chor Shor, one of the Balei HaTosfos, he's known as Yosef of Orleans, he says that a slave, Hebrew slave goes free in the Shemitah year. The Talmud never says this. The Talmud only says that Yovel frees the slaves, not Shemitah. I mean, it's so contradictory. It contradicts our Parsha, and it also contradicts Parsha's Bahar. Because if a Shemitah year canceled slavery, just like it cancels debt, right? Then the Torah should have said so. The Torah very vocally says so for a Yovel year, which is what Yirmiyahu Perek Lamed Bet is about. All right, which I just said. That's the Torah of Parshas Bahar. Okay? So comes Kasher to offer an amazing Kiddush. He says that in the time of the Tanakh, in the time of the Torah, What was an Eved's job to do? Where was an Eved's, like 95% of the work of an Eved was in the field.
In the field.
No one had people working in the houses. If you saw what houses 95% of the people lived in at that time, you couldn't have someone come into your house to do any work.
Too small.
The Gemara in Baba Basra says a mansion was 10 amos by 10 amos.
God.
10 feet by 10 feet.
Less than 400 square feet.
10 amos is about 250 square feet.
Yeah.
There's no work to do in the house. The work of an Eved was in the field. So this is what B'chor Shor says, suggests Kasher, that every slave got a year off for Shemitah. It didn't cancel the 6 years. It was just a year off. Not everyone starts the 6 years of slavery at the same time. Following? Okay. So Yirmiyahu is not contradictory at all. Every Eved Ivri works a total of 7 years. With 1 year in the middle, maybe a third year, maybe a sixth year, maybe a fourth year, maybe a second year. With 1 year in the middle where you have off for the Shemitah year. The Shemitah year, I mean, this is a Chumrah on the Eved. The Shemitah year doesn't count towards your 6 years because there's nothing for you to do. Mm-hmm. You've got to put in your 6 years, irrespective of the Shemitah year that will likely interrupt the 6 years. Okay, everybody see what I'm talking about?
Yes. Beautiful.
Now, if you read Pasuk Yudalev, it makes perfect sense. He says, at the end of the 7 years, including the one of which is a Shemitah year, set that person free because he already worked for you for 6 years. Okay, pick up a brisker thumb and you say, good, everyone makes sense now. The only problem I have with all this is that why did the Talmud mention this? So it's so clear. I mean, the Talmud should say so. No, there's something like this should appear in the Talmud. The Kasher points out that it does appear in the Zohar. Okay. Makasher Shtarpmanish, but, you know. Okay. So this is the final word on this. So Yirmiyahu says, because you didn't take care of freeing the slaves, I am going to present and call a drawer. I'm going to call freedom unto the pestilence and unto the enemy to come in and subjugate you and enslave you. Right? So I'll close with this for Parshas Mishpatim. The Sforno says that in Vayikra, the Torah says, Ukrosem dror l'chol yoshveha. Ukrosem dror l'chol yoshveha. Which means proclaim liberty for all its inhabitants. Sound familiar? You know where that's prominently declared in Philadelphia?
At the Liberty
Bell. Liberty Bell.
Right. And it was the Liberty Bell was assigned in 1826 at the 50th anniversary, the Yovel anniversary of this new country. You see all of the imagery of Parshas Bahar in there, right? And what the Sforno wonders is, what do you have to say, Ukrosem dror l'chol yoshveha? You should say, Ukrosem dror l'chol avodeha. Right? You should call liberty for all the slaves. What do you mean, call liberty for all its inhabitants? So the Sforno says, a society that does not treat liberty with the proper respect, then if some people don't have liberty, then it'll affect everybody. Okay, that's what, it was all nice to kiss up in 1826 about liberty, while so many people living in America did not have liberty. It was a war America was destined to fight. Okay, I won't get into all of the issues, but it was an original sin of our country to allow such a thing. All right. Okay, but the Gemara in Maseches Arachin has a halachic determination of what this means. The Gemara maintains that the only time that we have a declaration of Yovel is when all representation of the 12 tribes live in Israel. Mm-hmm. You get it? Ukrosim dror l'chol yoshveha. If there are some representations of the 12 tribes that are no longer in Israel, then Yovel stops. Okay? So that's the pshat, the drash, that the Gemara gives in Ukrosem dror l'chol yoshveha, as opposed to l'chol avadeha. And Yirmiyahu uses the word dror. No question that Yirmiyahu is aware of the psukim in Bahar and Mishpatim when crafting his speech regarding this parsha. To go full disclosure of the storyline is that Tzidkiyahu did listen to him, and he declared the freedom of the slaves who were being held beyond their time. But then he relented to the pressures of the Risharim of the day, and he went back on it. So as late as this time with Tzidkiyahu, there was still a chance, if the Israelites were more open with the liberty of other people, then God would have been perhaps more open with our liberty. But you see the word chofshi, levilti avod bom, biyehudi achihu, and all these words, chofshi and dror. And God says, okay, I'll open up the freedom of the sword to come in and conquer you. Okay? With all the other terrible things going on, there was still this Jews holding back on the liberty of other Jews. There is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, based on Pesukim in this Haftorah, when it says, and I told you, Biyom Hotzi'i Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim, I told you about the laws of Eved Ivri, and you're not paying attention to them. So what do we mean by Biyom Hotzi'i Osam Me'eretz Mitzrayim?
But it is, right? But it sounds terrible, Rabbi Kors, because it means that the authority supported this not freeing
it means that it was on the books. It's not just individuals who did this. No,
yeah.
It was. You can go to court. You can go to court, and you can and you can get your slave back. Right. That's what's so reprehensible about this. So, but the Yerushalmi maintains that that the these laws, it says that the day I took you out of Egypt, I taught you these laws. So that can be used to explain something that appears elsewhere in Sefer Yirmiyahu. In chapter 7, it's also a Haftorah, a very rare Haftorah, Parshas Tzav, when it's not Shabbos HaGadol or in a regular year, or Parshas Zohar in a leap year. Yirmiyahu says, why are you so scrupulous about your korbanos? I don't care about your korbanos. You might as well eat your olos. They don't mean anything to me. Did I tell you about, I'll say it in Hebrew, he says, Olosechem sfuol zivchechem v'ichlu basar, ki lo dibarti esav osechem b'yom hotzio sameretz mitzrayim al divrei olo v'zavach. I did not teach you the laws of korbanos the day I took you out of Egypt. But here in chapter 34, he's saying, and I told you the laws of Eved Ivri the day I took you out of Egypt. Do you see what's happening here? Yirmiyahu is very cleverly explaining that Parshas Mishpatim appears in the Torah before I taught you about Korbanos, before I even gave you a command to build the Mishkan. You get it? Parshas Mishpatim took precedence over the Korbanos. Right? And so you shouldn't put your such emphasis on Divrei Olav Azavach, chapter 7, when you're not paying proper attention to Kitik Ne'eved Ivri, the laws of Mishpatim, in chapter 34. Okay? The Kli Yakar, you've heard of him, or Ephraim Lynchus?
Yes.
The Kli Yakar says this brilliantly on the Pasuk, Ve'ele HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lifneihem. He says, these are the laws that you shall place before them. You know what them goes on?
Korbanos.
Now, while korbanos looks feminine, because it ends with a vav and a tav, but lifnehem, because korban is actually a masculine noun. That could be what Yirmiyahu meant when he said, Lo dibarti esavosechem biyom hotzio sameretz mitzrayim. In light of this Yerushalmi in Rosh Hashanah, that said, he says here in Perek Lamed Daled, that biyom hotzi, with the day I took you out of Egypt, I taught you about Eved Ivri. So comes the Yerushalmi to say that God taught this parsha back in Parshas Vo'era. You ever hear this Yerushalmi? Rashi does not hint to it, but it's in the Midrashim. That when it says Vayitzaveim el Paro Melech Mitzrayim, right? Vayitzaveim, he commanded them, right, regarding slavery, not only to go to Paro and demand freedom of slavery, but to make sure that the Jews heard the parsha of slavery while they were still slaves themselves. Okay. So that's biyom hotzi, but it makes the point that the priority was given in this realm over the ritualistic mitzvah of the korbanos, and therefore don't put the forest before the trees, and don't lose what God wanted to be the ikar. Okay. All right, I think that is what I will do in the treatment of this Haftorah. We are not reading this Haftorah this year, okay? In fact, Parshas Mishpatim's Haftorah is very rarely read.
But Rabbi Schwartz, but it never helped. The Karbonos was the major thing till the destruction of the temple. And it seems to me that God didn't want to restore the temple 100 years later, because it would have been the same temple with the major thing, Karbonos. That's how it is. That's how I see it.
Okay, well, this is a debate.
The rebellion of Bar Kokhba. Yes, okay. As simple as that.
Yeah. All right, let's see. That's a debate that you find in many of the commentaries, but...
I never read it. I just understood it.
Okay.
Myself, because it was already... Right, all this story continued and continued and continued.
Okay. Meanwhile, korbanos were definitely brought in the second base of Mikdash, and it was a mainstay of the service. Okay, and all right, but that is what. But Yirmiyahu is the most forceful of all the Nevi'im Achronim, who decry the scrupulous attention to the detail of the ritualistic korbanos, while they at the same time were lacking in their morality and their relationship with Bin Adam L'Chaveiro. Okay, so that's all I'll cover with the respect to the Haftorah that would have been. Now let's talk about the Haftorah that is. So this Haftorah tells the story of the repairs of the Beis HaMikdash, the Bedek HaBayis. I think I sent you, it's on two large pages. And what I'd like you to do first is to look at this. This is from a Lubavitch Merkaz Le'inyon Chinuch in the 1950s. They put out like this map of the kings of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Right, the two columns. You have the kings of Yehuda on the left. You have the kings of the northern tribes, what's called Israel, on the right. Okay, now the pictures, if you're used to looking at them, you can tell what the pictures mean. The A under Yehoshaphat means he supported Torah. The B means he was wise and he helped people study Torah. C, he promulgated justice. You see the scales. D, he supported the army and strengthened the army. He fortified the land. The F is prosperity. You see that stock chart there? Is prosperity. Now it's the G that I want to concentrate on. Okay? The G looks like a chuppah with two handshake, right? Two hands shaking. You see it? Mm-hmm. On the other side, with Achav, and these two kings, Achav and Yehoshaphat, started ruling just about the same time, right? They made a pact. The son of Yehoshaphat married the daughter of Achav. How do you like that? Okay? That daughter was named Ataliah, mm-hmm. Right? The mother was Izebel. And if you look at A, B, C, D there, oh my goodness, that's bad. A is he was dominated by his Phoenician wife, Jezebel. You see that king who was holding up his hand and that dominated hand? B means he violated the Torah. It was Avodah Zarah. You see the crack in the second of the Aseres HaDibros? C means that the prophets were persecuted. Like they're whipping the chauffeur, right? The prophets were persecuted. D means there was a famine during his time, right?
Mm.
Okay. E refers to this story with Eliyahu, mm-hmm. who killed 400 priests of Baal on the Mount Carmel, right? F means that Achav did defeat the Arameans, right? G means he murdered Navot for his vineyard. And finally, H, right? H is what the G was for Yehoshaphat. H means that Achav's daughter Ataliah married Yehoshaphat's son, Yehoram. Okay? And that produced a child named Ahaziah. Okay? Now, this, you can think, should have been a good thing, right? For the two kingdoms to unite.
Hmm.
What were they waiting for? Didn't it happen in history where the daughter of the king of Spain married the son of the king of France, and you made alliances that way? Shlomo did that with practically every king in the world, right? On the face of it, this might have been a good idea, but it wasn't a good idea because of who it was. Yehoshaphat was a good king, as you can see. But Achav definitely was not. It was a worthwhile thing, maybe, to unite the kingdoms, but not with a daughter of Izebel. Okay? This produced a woman, Ahaziah, murdered every single last descendant she could get her hands on.
Atalia.
Of this woman, what did I say? Atalia.
Atalia.
Okay.
Atalia murdered every single descendant from the house of David that she could get her hands on. Okay. And the it says in the Tanakh that she almost succeeded in wiping out the Davidic line. The Gemara, which is always very, very clever at making these connections, said that there was a time where David was responsible for the killing of many, many people for irresponsibly putting someone in danger for asking him for help. That was the Kohanim of Nov. He should have realized by then that, remember, when he came to Nov for help, for food, for a sword, the Kohen Gadol was, says, Vayicharad, he was very frightened. What are you doing here? What is the king's son-in-law doing here? So David said, I'm on a secret mission. David is a fugitive. He knows the king is trying to kill him and that he puts in danger anybody. He knows what Shaul is capable of by now. And he puts Achav into grave danger. So, Achimelech. Gemara says, Mida keneged Mida. Because there was one Kohen who was able to escape. His name was Evyatar. Mm-hmm. Because Evyatar managed to escape, so that's why one child managed to escape Atalia's murderous vendetta against the house of David.
Did she kill her own grandchildren?
Yes, she killed. Well, the grandchildren, the descendants of hers would be Ahaziah. So I don't know if she had grandchildren. Ahaziah was very young. I'm not sure if she had grandchildren, but she certainly had. These was related to her, at least through marriage, right? So what was her plan? I mean, she wanted to rule over both kingdoms together simultaneously, right? She was just murderous. Do I have to explain? Aren't all murderers deranged, right? So don't you have to be insane to commit murder? So the point is, she ruled for 6 years with an iron fist, introduced idolatry into the land, led to horrible ruination of the people. And finally, only after 6 years were the people capable of standing up to her and finally killed her. Same way they killed her mother, Izebel, right? So here's what happened. When she went on this rampage against the house of David, someone whisked away a one-year-old baby. Right? Someone whisked away a child. It was 1 year old. This child's name was Yoash. Yep. Okay? And Yoash spent 6 years in hiding. It's amazing because Atalia was in charge of the palace. Child was hidden in the palace, right, by a nursemaid. Must have been a very lonely early life for Yoash. He did not leave his hiding place for 6 years. He spent the age 1 to 7, right, in seclusion. Okay? And it was crucial that hardly anyone, that no one should know that he's there, right? So finally, after 6 years, they finally had the strength to kill this wicked person, okay? And this 7-year-old child left his seclusion to rule over the kingdom of David, the youngest king of our history. And this king, this young 7-year-old, proved to be worthy for a time. The only one of all the kings that has both a Sefer Torah, you see like Yehoshaphat's Torah, mm-hmm. you see Yoash's Torah, but he also has, you see the broken tablets like Yehoram and Ahaziah and Ataliah, you see it? And Achav and Yehoram, you see all these broken tablets? Okay. So Yoash started off as a good king. There was a Kohen Gadol named Yehoyada who helped raise him, taught him, and taught him well. See the Torah, they promulgated the Torah, he broke all the idols, he destroyed the idolatry. D, you see the D? That's a little black thing. That black thing in the back is a temple. You see that little tool next to it? Right? You see that's to like... yeah, it's to maybe...
repair the temple.
Yeah, to repair, to lay bricks. Right? So the D is our Haftarah. Okay? On the Parsha, where we talk about the obligation to donate the obligatory communal donations, Chatzi Shekel. So we read about the collection of Shkom. It wasn't a half shekel collection. It was a voluntary collection. Mm-hmm. We read about the collection of the time of Yoash to fix the cracks in the walls of the Beis HaMikdash. Those cracks are called bedek. Bedek habayis means the cracks in the wall. And because of that terminology, just bistam, usually shul donations are called bedek habayis. Have you ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Like on the tzedakah box, it says bedek habayis. Because all shuls have cracks in their walls. Right? And all shuls have leaks in the bricks. And all shuls have roofs that leak. Right? So, if I can make an appeal now for our building campaign, anybody who, so please, you can see Jenny Michael. She's an officer of the shul. She'll take your calls right after the shir. Right? I want to interrupt this for a moment for the famous Yehoash inscription. Does it ring a bell to anybody? That's on the back of this page. You see it here? The Yoash inscription that Camille, did you put it on at the beginning of the shir? Right? It describes a tablet that was found, I think it was 2011. Just around this time in 2011, in February 2011, a tablet was found in Yerushalayim that was found to be carbon dated 2,300 years old. And that means that it's older than that. That means it started to decay 2,300 years ago. And the tablet was consistent with being around the time of Yoash. It had gold melted into the tablet, right? And I would say that, you know, it's been 10 years already. But I remember, you know, whenever things like this surface, the initial reaction of the archaeological community is always skepticism, mm-hmm. right? I'll admit that whoever wrote it is trying very hard to make you think that it's genuine. Sometimes, you know, methinks the queen doth protest too much, you know, like you're trying too hard, and they're using terminologies that they're trying too hard to be convincing. Okay. I'm not going to get into all the nitty gritty of that, but if you want to just do Google, but I have whole kinds of, debates over whether it's real or not. but you can just maybe Google Yoash Stone, you know, February 2011. Trying to think what would be a good title for you. The Yoash inscription. Just look for that. Okay. Usually it's spelled Jehoash, J-E-H-O-A-S-H. Okay, this page gives you like a whole overview of the whole thing. All right. And it's really profoundly similar to the biblical story. There's one thing that appears in the stone that it's really a beautiful part of the story is that in the Haftorah, as well as in the stone, it says that they didn't have to keep records because the people involved were scrupulously careful of not wasting anything, and they had impeccable reputations. And they worked be'emunah. All right, I'm not sure that maybe that was good for them. I think it's still very important for a shul to always have a spreadsheet. Everyone should know what they're spending, what they're bringing in, what they're taking out. You know, you can't run a successful campaign without some kind of oversight, right? And yet, it says that this particular project was done be'emunah. Right, I'd like to think that it means that the people involved were totally beyond reproach. There was no one had any chas v'sholom, any ingratiation. Okay, when it came to Moshe, he was accused of taking some kickbacks. Right, remember from the collection of the Mishkan. They used the some extra shkalim for the hooks, right? For the vavim, right? And then he was accused of ingratiating Aaron, right? With some of the pidyon money for the bechorim, right? So this, look, whenever money is being counted, money is being distributed, the Torah is very careful, making exact delineations and exact cheshbonot of what's being spent and what it's being spent on. Okay, I'm just pointing that out, but that is similar from the stone as well as the archaeological find. And here is the amazing thing, and this happened again later in history with our second youngest king, is that things did not look good for Israel when Yoash became king. Things look profoundly bleak. Look at the history. Ahav's son, Ahaziah, and his other son, Yehoram. Ahaziah died without a child. So both of them were killed by Yehu. Okay. Actually, Ahaziah just died without a child, but he fell out of a window, defenestration. He fell out of a window, and then his father asked, remember the name of the Avodah Zarah? His father asked in order to find out if he was going to survive his wounds from falling out the window. And when Eliyahu heard, "You went to this Avodah Zarah? Don't you know that there's a prophet in Israel? You're the king. Come to me. I'll tell you what will happen to your son." Right? He went to an Avodah Zarah called Baal Zvuv. Baal Zvuv, Lord of the Flies, also known as Beelzebub. Right? Baal Zvuv. So that's Ahaziah dies of those wounds. Then Yehoram is killed by Yehu. Right? And Ahab had 70 sons. They were all killed by Yehu. All right, and look what's going. That's the kingdom of Yehuda of Israel. Look what's happening in Yehuda. Yehoram is killed by Yehu. Right, Ahaziah is killed by Yehu. Okay. So, and Ataliah is killing all of the descendants of David. And there's a 1-year-old child, now 7, who comes out of that to rule. So we should please, when reading the Haftorah, do not fail to recognize how the kingdom of Israel and thus Mashiach was spared and survived as a result of this man. I'm afraid history does not acknowledge his role in the messianic line. His name is Yehoyada. Please remember the name, Yehoyada. Okay, you will read about him this Shabbos in the Haftorah. His name is Yehoyada. Okay? And he was the Kohen Gadol all the time. All right. And while Yehoyada was alive, everything Yoash did was good. As you can see, Yoash ruled for quite some time. Right? He ruled 41 years. Right? The end of his reign is listed here. What happened that made E? Anybody looking at the pictures? Okay.
He with Egypt. He wouldn't listen about Egypt.
You're thinking of Yoshiyahu. The 8-year-old king. That's later when the Egyptians wanted free passage, and Yirmiyahu said, "Let them go." And Yoshiyahu didn't listen. The names are similar, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What happened in E? If you look on the side, you'll see turned to idolatry after Yehoyada's death. That's what it was. It was all Yehoyada. I don't want to take too much away from Yoash, but he was just a kid. No, but by this time he's older. By this time he's in his 30s. So the Yehoyada was meant everything to him. And when Yehoyada died, Yoash slides into a bad place. Look what happens. Right? Turn to idolatry after Yehoyada's death. But worse. F, what F stands for here in Yoash's column, led to a very famous kina that we say on Tisha B'Av. Does it sound familiar? First, let me tell you what it is. It's the death of Zechariah. Not the Zechariah we know from Treyasar that we read about on Chanukah. This is the son of Yehoyada. Came to rebuke Yoash for his newfound idolatry. My father just died, and you're turning to idolatry? And he killed him. He had Zechariah killed. And just before Zechariah died, I'm not telling you Medrash here, this is in Divrei Hayamim. It's not in Melachim Bet, though. It's only in Divrei Hayamim. Right before Zechariah died, he said three Hebrew words. Anyone remember them? I'll paraphrase in English. He said three words before he died. Yireh Hashem v'yidrosh. May God see what you're doing to me and hold you responsible. Yireh Hashem v'yidrosh. And that, you will recognize this in a moment, is the kina that we say on Tisha B'Av when Nebuzaradan, after destroying the temple, saw blood spurting out of the ground. Right? Now, I don't know how to take this in pshat. It's a drash. What it means is that Zechariah, sometimes, you know, maybe you misspoke too. Okay, yes, you were definitely killed without good cause. But to bring upon such guilt upon your people, Yireh Hashem v'yidrosh, Nebuzaradan kept on killing more and more people to find out, what is this blood? Why is this blood spurting all over the place? And it only stopped spurting. He kept on killing more people, children and old people, women, men, old, young, everyone. And they only stopped bubbling when he stopped killing people was when he came to learn what the source of the blood was Zechariah. Right? So that's what the F stands for there. You see, just like under you had such a picture for Achav, the subjugation of the shofar right here, it's the murder of the shofar representing the prophet. Okay, Yoash, for all his troubles, he was good for 30, 35 years. The end of his kingdom, he was assassinated. Right, you see? See the assassination there at the end, to the right? Okay, a lot of bad things happening at the end there. But thankfully, that does not make its way into our Haftorah, right? The Haftorah is limited to the collection for the temple treasury and the repair of the Bedek HaBayis, right? The Torah, the Beis HaMikdash fell into awful disrepair. In fact, it was laid without usage. It wasn't used, the Beis HaMikdash. I'm going to conclude with one of the most cryptic prophecies in Tanakh. So cryptic that the man who spoke it didn't even know what he was talking about. I'm referring to the very end of Daniel.
The Valley of the Bones?
I'm sorry?
Is that the Valley of Dry Bones?
No, that's Yechezkel chapter 37. Daniel chapter 12 ends by saying to wait 1,290 years, and if necessary, another 1,335 years. Very cryptic. And you must wait that amount of time after the altar of God is made into a shikutz shomeim. Shikutz shomeim. Shikutz like a something disgusting. Shomeim, something destroyed. And the Malbim says the following. The Malbim says there were five times in our history that the Beis HaMikdash, that the altar in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim was halted and made shomeim. The first time is our story, Atalia. Second time is during the reign of Achaz, the father of Chizkiyahu. The third time was when the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. The fourth time is before the Chanukah story. The fifth time is when the Romans destroyed the second temple. The Malbim says that we're supposed to wait 1,290 years from one of those five times. And if necessary, if that doesn't work because we haven't done a good tshuva yet, we have to wait another 1,335 years. The question is, which one of these five? So these five were all shomeim, but the Malbim maintains that only one of them was a shikutz shomeim. The Chanukah story was a shikutz, no doubt. What do I mean? They offered pigs. That's shikutz. Shikutz shomeim. It was shikutz, but it wasn't necessarily shomeim. The altar was functioning. It was just functioning for pigs. Right? The Malbim maintains that the only one that fits Shikutz Shomeim was the Achaz. And he made a cheshbon from 1290 and 1335 years from when Achaz cleared out the Beis HaMikdash. Achaz is not on this thing. It would be the next page. That Achaz cleared out the Beis HaMikdash and made it look like a resemblance of the Aramean temple. That though 1290 plus 1335 from that year was 1915. Mm. 1915 CE.
Mm.
And he wrote this in the 1860s. And he said that is the input from Daniel. Camille just mentioned Yechezkel because in that prophecy of the dry bones, right on the heels of the right before the prophecy of Gog and Magog. So the Malbim uses the Yechezkel prophecy to say that he predicted this in the 1860s. Maybe it was already mashma that with the warlike tendencies of the Kaiser, but he predicted that there will be a world war in 1915 with Germany at the center of it. Okay, world war because Gog and Magog is gematria 70, the 70 nations of the world, right? And Magog is the brother of Germany. Ashkenaz and Magog are brothers in Sefer in Parshas Noach. Right? So, insofar as World War I was supposed to be the war to end all wars, but it guaranteed the fighting of another world war. So, but this is really not our concern now. Our concern is Atalia. He thought that what Atalia did was not Shikut Shomeim. First of all, because if you count from Atalia, then Mashiach should have come already before the Malbim. Right? So he couldn't use that year. And if he went to the Churban, he said that's too much later. And it would be around now, right? And if you do the Hanukkah story, then you're really in trouble. That's not going to happen for a while, right? All right, whatever it is, I'll tell you over the years, some Jews were convinced that that year would be 1665, right? 5335 in the calendar from the creation. It was amazing. People independently determined from the end of Daniel that Mashiach was supposed to come in the year 5335, right? And the gematria of the last two psukim of Sefer Daniel, where God tells him how long to wait, exactly of those two psukim, the two long psukim is 5335. It's one of the most incredible coincidences you can find in terms of gematria. All right, but our prophecy is not so much eschatological in that realm. It is, however, the Haftorah that has always given the Shul collections its name. Look in the Haftorah for that. Please remember to take note of the hero of the story who was really Yehoyada. The Horai, as soon as Yehoyada dies, Mispar de Chavila, everything falls apart. Okay, I hope this chart will help you navigate these names. And this you can read yourself if you want to see some of the the materials about that stone. And hopefully we'll start to get this. When we read Parsha Shkolim, you know that Purim is right around the corner. Next week we'll be learning what's called the Haftorah of Parsha Zohar. And next week I think I'm not going to give you any source material because we're just going to learn the story inside the text. Okay, we didn't do too much of that today. But we're going to learn pasuk by pasuk. So make sure you have a Tanakh in front of you next week. Okay, a Tanakh, which is Sefer Shmuel Aleph. And then we'll do the textual work there. Okay, everybody, that was a fast hour.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Cool. Have a great day, everybody. A great week.
Thank you so much.
Remember Wednesday night at 8, we have the Minchas Chinuch. Okay, we're doing Mitzvah Yud Dalid. All right, and everyone stay safe, stay healthy, stay well.
And what time do you have also such a Zoom too? On
8 o'clock tomorrow morning, I have a Zoom. I'll call the Seder at 9 a.m. We're doing Maseches Demai tomorrow. If you always wanted to learn Demai, then show up at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. And
if you want to know what Demai is about, okay. All right, everybody. Hi, everyone. All the best.